The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record Koan Collection, Case 21. The pointer, setting up the banner of the teaching, establishing the essential meaning. This is adding flowers to brocade. Strip off the blinders, unload the saddle pack. This is the season of the great peace. If you can discern the phrase outside of patterns, and then when one is raised, you understand three. Otherwise, if you're not yet this way, as before, humbly listen to this treatment. The main case. A monk asked Master Zhermun, how is it when the lotus flower has not yet emerged from the water? Zhermun said, the lotus flower. The monastic said, how about when it has emerged from the water? Zhermun said, lotus leaves. The poem. Lotus flower, lotus leaves, he reports for you to know. How can emerging from the water compare to when it has not yet emerged? North of the river, south of the river, ask old Wang. Fox doubt after fox doubt. Oh, good morning. So this weekend we've had an introductory retreat, and many of you are here, have been with us for the weekend. We've talked about a lot of different aspects of Buddhist practice. We've also done Buddhist practice together. We've talked about different ways that meditation is taken up, breath practice, practicing that in different ways, shikantaza, and the koan. And the koan is a, you know, I mentioned yesterday that the Buddha said there are three essential aspects to training, to practice the precepts, the moral teachings, and to base our lives in a moral life, to cease from creating harm and do what is good, to quiet the restless winds and waters of the mind and develop concentration, and to see clearly. And seeing here is not specifically a visual, but it's experiencing directly into the nature of the self, into the nature of reality, so that we can dissolve the false views and the attachments and the basis for all of our suffering that is really predicated on a particular view of ourselves in the world. Without that view, that suffering and those attachments not only are illogical, but they just fall away. So, practicing the precepts, sort of working on our, you know, thoughts, words, and actions is perhaps one of the more accessible aspects of practice. Calming the mind is easy enough to understand and to put into practice. Gaining direct insight is more delicate, because it's not a conceptual understanding. It's not just about acquiring knowledge. We know how to do that. But it's how do you experience something directly that you can't touch with your senses, you can't know with your thinking mind. How do you experience something that by its very nature, in a sense, can't be experienced? Because to experience it means someone is still there. There's still subject and object having that experience. That's why it's a mystical practice. That's why we sit in a training hall, a hall of awakening, on these diamond seats of meditation rather than a classroom, right, with a chalkboard and desks. That has its own purpose. This is different. And so the koan is a way that is developed through the Zen tradition, beginning in China, of how do you bring your attention to an essential question and ask, not with your thoughts, not with your rational mind, but ask with your whole being. How do you ask directly? This Anga we're studying within the Lotus Sutra, we're studying Buddha nature. Buddha nature is in essence what the Buddha was enlightened to. What was it that liberated him from all the constraints and the bonds of and hindrances that we all experience universally as human beings? We call that Buddha nature, the nature of Buddha, of enlightenment, of enlightened mind, of enlightened nature, unbound, vast, boundless, undefinable, unborn, undying, suchness. There are many, many ways we speak of that in Buddhism, emptiness. It's the basis for the whole thing, right? It is the basis for every form of practice, certainly in our tradition, for every teaching. It's the underlying direction, we might say. And it's, I think, extremely good and timely medicine for our time. Because we live in a time, in a country, in a culture that kind of manufactures insecurity and doubt towards the self, that manufactures and sort of has industrialized and commodified, because it is, after all, a commodity, that deep sense, not just that we can at times act in a way that are unworthy, but rather we ourselves are unworthy in some intrinsic way. And when we arrive at that place, in a sense, there's not much you can do, right? If that's your nature, if that's who you are, then tough, you know? I mean, what can you do if that's just the way you are? Now, anybody in this hall doesn't believe that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. You would not have listened to the teachings and been drawn towards them. But we can still have very strong habits and stories that undermine this faith in Buddha nature, that are communicating, we are communicating directly to ourselves at the same time that we are practicing having confidence and trusting in Buddha nature. We can at the same time be doubting that and feeling insecure about that and feeling like that there's something fundamentally missing and that we will never be able to accomplish Buddhism presents us with as our birthright. And I think of that often as sort of the oldest story in the world, right? Sort of between good and evil, right? The story between good and evil, between living and dying, between war and peace, right? Wanting to live and create life and wanting to not live and destroy life. Where does all of that in the world come from, but from within us? And that ancient and very present conflict, that battle that too often is going on within us. And so as practitioners, we have to, if that is strong within us, we have to, that becomes a very essential part of our practice, how to see it as a story, how to understand it as something that is, we weren't born with, is not who you are. But as a story you tell yourself about yourself. I sort of came upon that for myself years ago in moments of struggle when I would just say to myself, this is a story, this is the story of Shugen, right? This is the story I tell myself about me. And just saying that to myself really helped, because it was like, oh, it's just a story, right? I mean, it wasn't quite that effective. I was still caught, but it gave me a different perspective. It created a little bit of space that I was able to see myself telling the story rather than just being the thing. I mean, I think Zazen itself, if we do it correctly, is one of the most powerful ways of freeing ourselves from this. Metta practices, bringing forth loving kindness and compassion for others and ourselves, is very essential. Having faith in Buddha nature. The Dalai Lama said many years ago, when teachers were talking to him about, I wasn't there for this conversation, but I read about it, that they were talking to him about the sort of epidemic among Western practitioners of self-doubt and self-judgment, harsh self-judgment, and what to do about it. And he said, maybe not concentrate so much on the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering, right? Because that teaching, which is really just a basic truth about how our consciousness works and makes of things in the world, can very easily become, I am suffering, and I am suffering because I deserve to be suffering. It can be just a sort of a compounding of that view of self-doubt. He said, maybe better to concentrate on Buddha nature. Having faith in Buddha nature, that we are within ourselves, before a single action is taken, regardless of anything we've done in our life, our very nature is complete, is perfect. Perfect in the sense of without flaw. Perfect in the sense of undivided. In the sense of nothing needs to be added or corrected. Then one might rightly ask, well, if that's true, if that's our nature, then why is the world kind of the way it is? Why don't I manifest that in every moment? And so in the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, Tathagatagarbha is another way of saying Buddha nature. Tathagata is another name for the Buddha, the one thus come. The Buddha said, that hidden, or saw, that hidden within the kleshas, all of our negativity, our negative mental traits and habits and attachments and views based in greed, desire, anger, delusion, within all of that sort of mass that generates all of our unhappiness, he says, there is all along seated augustly and unmovingly the Buddha's wisdom, the Buddha's view, and the Buddha's body. Every being, though they may find themselves with all sorts of karmic entanglements, have Buddha nature that is eternally unsullied, untainted, and that is replete with the virtues that are no different from a Buddha. And that's the basis of Buddhist practice, that we're human beings, right? We can agree on that. The Buddha was a human being. What the Buddha is saying here is that we have everything that the Buddha had in terms of our basic equipment. No different. And he went on to say, because the Buddha wanted to disclose a Buddha nature, help us to see it so that we can live it, he expounded the Dharma, the sutras, in order that we might liberate ourselves from our kleshas, from our afflictive emotions, which is another way of saying liberate our afflictive emotions, liberate our suffering, liberate our bound and entangled mind and body, and reveal this nature. Such is the Dharma of every Buddha. And that's the nature of every being. It's just that they are covered by sentient beings' kleshas. That's why in the pointer, Yuanwu says this is adding flowers to brocade, that every form of practice, every teaching, everything we've been doing this weekend, this monastery itself, is in a sense adding flowers to brocade. Brocade, of course, is a bunch of flowers. And so to do all of this, in a sense, Buddha nature's the brocade, all of this is adding more flowers. So in that sense, it's not necessary, it's not redundant, because we already possess Buddha nature, have Buddha nature. There is no language that actually adequately expresses our relationship with Buddha nature, because it's not a relationship. It's not a thing that we possess, that we have, that is within us. But we have no other language to use, because language is about things and their relationship to other things. And so Buddhism koans and practices and metaphors and parables and similes. And so in that, to try and help us to begin to hold in our mind, how could that be? How could my nature be complete and perfect when look at what I do? Like, look at what I think. Or maybe don't. When I look back, what I've done in my life, I've hurt people. I've done stupid things. I've done selfish things. In fact, every time I've hurt someone, it's been a selfish act. It was always a selfish act. In a sense, there is no hurting outside of that, which means there's no hurting of ourselves or others without the attachment to a sense of self. That's why liberating ourselves from the kleshas ultimately means liberating ourselves from that idea of an independent, autonomous self. And so in that sutra, there are seven or eight similes to try and bring home this sense of Buddha nature. And so the Buddha said, it's like a kernel of wheat that has not yet had its husk removed. Someone who doesn't have the ability to see might foolishly disdain it and consider it to be something that should be thrown away. But when it is cleaned, that kernel can be now used. In like fashion, good friends, when I observe, the Buddha is speaking, when I observe sentient beings with my Buddha eye, I see that the husk of kleshas covers their limitless Buddha vision. The kleshas, again, are all of our afflictive, entangled, karmic emotions and thoughts and habit patterns. So with the appropriate skillful means, I expound the Dharma to enable sentient beings to remove their kleshas, purify their universal wisdom, and attain in all worlds the highest true enlightenment. And even in this, the language displays its imperfection, to remove the kleshas, to purify, to attain. In actual fact, that is not what's happening. But when we practice, particularly in the beginning, it very much has the appearance of removing. And so we talk about letting go, which only makes sense if there is something that you have and now you can let it go, like an object. That's not actually the truth, but it's true enough as we begin practicing. We have nothing to purify because Buddha nature is in and of itself untainted. And yet we have the sense of being impure or, you know, cloudy or a little confused. And so the sense of purifying kind of makes sense to us, right? When our clothes get dirty, we put them in the wash, we clean them, right? When something is dirty, we wipe it clean. So there's a sense of removing something so that what is there can be clear and bright. That's why the mirror is used so often. And to attain in all worlds the highest true enlightenment. Well, if we already have Buddha nature, then what is there to attain? But again, this language is helpful because it conveys a sense of what we are doing. And then along the way, we with our insight, we begin to understand directly, oh, we're not actually removing anything. There is nothing actually to purify, and nothing actually is attained. That's what's attained. But to think about that is nothing like the experience. And that each and every person is just such a person. And so here this student comes to this old master, Chinese master Zhermun, and says, how is it when the lotus flower is not yet emerged from the water? So the lotus flower is another image for Buddha nature. It is an exquisite flower. I hope you've all had the pleasure of experiencing a lotus flower up close. They are kind of perfect. And one reason that they're used as such a powerful image is because the roots of that flower are in muddy soil, right? So this exquisite flower grows out of very muddy, murky water and soil. So Buddha nature arises out of the turmoil and the challenges of our life, out of greed, anger, and delusion. And so how is it when the lotus flower has not yet emerged. Has not yet emerged, and Zhurmun says, a lotus flower. That's easy enough to understand intellectually, but it's not so easy to realize. And that's the nature of the koan, is that we actually have to let go of our intellectual understanding and enter into that directly. And that's part of their training. It's, what is it that you enter into? Here's the question. Here's an image of a lotus flower. What is it that you're entering into with your mind? It is your meditation. And in order to do that, we have to let go of the sense of, I am this. This defines me. This confines me. This is the limit of what I am. I have to let go of that view, that attachment to the sense of this body, this mind, Shugen, everything that comes with it, as me, so that I can enter into this world, right? And when we realize that we're in every moment just creating one world after the next, it's no different. And that we are defining each of those worlds as myself, we're using the same power of the mind to create a different world within a meditation, consciously, in a sense, a purpose, an enlightened purpose. And so here in this simile, the husk covers the seed, the cloud covers the sun's brilliance, the dust obscures the mirror. All of these are ancient images, similes for how do we understand Buddha nature, and how it can be so hidden from us. An old master said about this, but say, is this flower before and after it emerges from the water the same or different? If you can see it this way, then I'll grant that you've had an entry. But nevertheless, if you say it's the same before and after, then you confuse your Buddha nature and becloud true thusness. If it's the same, then what are we doing here? We don't need to practice. If you say it's different, then mind and environment are not yet forgotten, and you descend to travel the road of interpretation. When will this ever cease? If they're different, then maybe we are intrinsically messed up. And so what he's presenting here, as happens so frequently in the teachings, is that duality, the way we tend to see things. It's either yes or no. It's the same or different. And either way will lead us right back into the same hole, because it's based on the same view. Things are separate and divided and distinct, and you just have to decide which side of the fence are you going to be on. Who are your friends going to be, and who are your enemies going to be? And what he's saying is there's another way. That road of interpretation never ends. And so first we have to recognize, what is the husk? What are the clouds? What is the dust? What are these point images pointing to? And so we have to recognize essentially the First Noble Truth. That's an essential part of right understanding, the first of the Eightfold Path, to recognize and basically own up to our suffering, to our greed, to our anger, to our delusion, our confusion, to our pride, to our jealousy, and begin to learn how to honestly to take it seriously, as I spoke about yesterday in the group, take it seriously while we take ourselves less and less seriously. Or rather, maybe that's not a good way of saying it, is to take the suffering seriously, but take ourselves more lightly. And so we have to actually learn how to face what is difficult to face, to bear what sometimes is difficult to bear, patience, patience paramita, to be uncomfortable within a path that is actually where we're learning how to be compassionate in that very moment of discomfort, how to face our self-doubt and self-judgment with compassion in a way that isn't denying it or suppressing it, isn't telling a different story, a better story, but is actually just facing that naked truth of our delusion, of that story. And that is one of the most powerful things that practice teaches us. And if we, until we begin to really develop that capacity to sit within our discomfort, not a lot more is going to be possible. We will very frequently and quickly get to a point we can't go past, because we'll keep getting stopped by all the different forms in which that discomfort shows up. That sense of self, which is not being affirmed, is being threatened, or whatever, and the discomfort that raises. And we will revert back to old ways. And being free of that whole paradigm of right or wrong, good or bad, success or failure is key. Because as long as that's sort of our standard, we will continue to fail. And that's hard to endure for long. Usually what happens is it is hard to endure, and so finally we start to give it up. Sometimes students aren't able or willing to give it up, and so they just leave. But to appreciate that all along, this seed wants to sprout. That's what it's here for. I've been reading, I'm almost always reading some books about trees and trees and their associated neighbors. And this book that I've been reading, and it's written by a scientist, but he just gets very passionate and enthusiastic about seeds. And he talks about how they contain the embryo, right? So they sort of contain the whole thing from the beginning, and they're just waiting. And they have internal instructions that activate when their waiting time is finished and they're in a conducive environment, and now they can begin to sprout. And they are very good at waiting. They have great patience. And seeds have actually been discovered that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they've been able to germinate them. You know, transferring that simile to ourselves, too much patience can ruin the seed. Right? Too much patience, and we becomes waiting. And we just see that opportunities have been lost. And that from the outside, the author said, the seed appears lifeless, right? There's nothing going on. That's not true. Inside, there is life. There is movement. It's very subtle. It's not discernible to one who's looking from the outside. But what has to happen for that seed to fulfill itself is the husk has to open. Now, some husks are thick, right? And so they might have to be scratched, scarified, to allow enough moisture to come in for them to begin to crack open, right? So those cracks may be caused by the slings and arrows of our lives, the challenges, the difficulties, disappointments, the things that don't go the way we planned. Or they might come from having everything that we could want, and that's not enough. Those seeds can also be opened by the surrounding fungi and bacteria in the soil, right? Things that might seem to be adverse to the seed's well-being. Or the grinding of coarse soil particles that keeps grinding against the husk and begins to wear it down. We call that mutual polishing within a sangha. Our rough edges come up against each other and we sort of grind ourselves down into smooth, radiant pearls. Some seeds are very thick coats and require fire. So the lotus in the fire, they won't open until there's fire. There's a story the Buddha told, I believe it was a Buddha, that some people awaken and begin to reflect on and turn towards the question of life and death when they hear about somebody in a distant village far away they've never met who has gotten very ill and has died. And that's enough. For others, it doesn't happen until somebody in their village. For another, it's not until somebody in their family. And for others, it's not until they themselves that they begin to actually realize, oh, this doesn't last forever. What have I been doing? What should I be doing? What am I doing? And some, of course, even then, don't. I've known some. The Buddha raised bodhicitta with all of his wealth and his pleasure palaces. Milarepa raised bodhicitta after having created a hell realm. This author said, equipped with everything needed to become a fully mature plant, a seed simply waits until the conditions are right. And although seeds may seem to be asleep as they lay in the soil, they are fully responsive to the changes in their environment. What a perfect parallel. That bodhicitta, how is it that you are here? What is going on? People you know, friends, family, people in very similar situations might hear about this and it just goes right by. It doesn't mean anything to them, doesn't respond to anything in them. And that's okay. But you have responded to something. That seed is responsive to its environment. Messages get in. And again, this is just a way of speaking. There is not a thing, a seed, an object inside of us called Buddha nature. It's a way of talking about something that is ineffable. Before the lotus flower emerges, how is it a lotus flower? There is change in practice. Of course, we come seeking change in our lives, in our experiences within ourselves. Change is the nature of everything, but there's no transformation. Not in the sense that we tend to think of it as something transforms into something else. That isn't what's happening here. Something becoming something new. And what that means is that every kind of flower, every size, every color, every shape, every state of health, every age is complete. In this realm, there's no high or low. There's no inside or outside. There's no worthy or unworthy. That's why that story that we can tell ourselves about ourselves is so, maybe that's why it's so painful. Because it is so contrary to our actual nature, right? I mean, think about it. If you tell a story that's really close to the truth, doesn't it like create a sense of affirmation? Doesn't everything start to line up and move together harmoniously? The fact that it's so painful, maybe that's an indication of it's not true. Dogen said, living beings, all are Buddha nature. Some people think Buddha nature is like seeds of grasses and trees. And when the Dharma rain, and we in this Lotus Sutra we read this parable about the Dharma rain, that when the rain falls, it falls everywhere, equally. Right? And that every plant that is needing that water, that moisture, soaks it in a way that's appropriate to its need. And so each of us encountering the Dharma, and the Dharma has no preference, right? It has no inside and outside. It's not corruptible because it's not a thing. It can't be bought and sold. It can't be possessed. And so when that rain falls down and we hear it or we don't, or we hear it lightly or we hear it deeply, We're receiving that rain in a way that is appropriate to our present conditions. That's all. And that as we practice, that is what changes. It's our ability to encounter the Dharma, which really means ourselves and everything, in a way that is more and more in alignment with our nature, which means more and more completely. And that you experience that as a sense of affirmation. I remember even my very early practice, where I was on my own, isolated, I didn't know anything. All I knew was meditation. And that's what I was doing. And that somehow it was connected to Buddhism, but I didn't know anything about that. I mean, what could I do? I could look in an encyclopedia to learn about Buddhism at that point. And even when moments where I thought, I'm no good at this, I'm no good at meditation, and I'm not doing it very well, and it's hard, and ooh, that's kind of unpleasant. Even in the midst of all of that, there was this sense that there was something that was true. And that didn't make sense to me. Like, what? But it was there. It was kind of undeniable. How to explain such things? It doesn't really matter in a way. What's important is that in such moments we trust. We listen, we follow that which we don't necessarily understand. But not in a blind way, in an examining way, in a have faith, practice, and verify that faith kind of way. That's what this path is based on. And so we investigate, what is the seed? What is the flower? Why, when the student said, what about after it has emerged from the water? This lotus flower, lotus leaves, Zhurmun said. Why didn't he say lotus flower? That's what makes it such a brilliant koan. And to really understand that deeply, what about after it has emerged? Lotus leaves. And so we examine this mind, this face, this breath, this thought, this emotion, but we examine it in a different kind of way, in a not accumulating knowledge kind of way, in a not, I already know the answer kind of way. And it's much more courageous than that. It's not just trying to affirm and confirm what we already know. What's the point of that anyway? But rather, it's trying to discover what is actually true. And not in the sense of the truth, because that's just another thing in our mind, but what is true. And we'll know because the effect that it will have in our lives is consistent with when things are true. They bring forth life. That's why paths of delusion and destruction take so much enormous energy to keep them going. And that we put so much energy of all kinds into such destructive forces is just a sign of our faith and conviction in the self, in false views, and in destruction itself. And so it takes a great turning to not take a single step and arrive where we've always been. And so in the poem, he talks about fox doubt after fox doubt. How can the lotus before it's emerged compare with how it is after it has emerged? What about when we let go of comparing altogether? In your zazen, please do that. Stop comparing one period to the next, one mental state to the next, one emotion to the next, one achievement to the next, because that's just a tyranny to actually let go. And it takes time because we just don't trust that. It's hard to trust that. But the evidence of what happens when we don't trust it and we keep doing all of that judging and comparing is our unhappiness, is our turmoil, is our discontentment. The evidence is pretty clear. We don't need more studies and reports on the matter. But, you know, we have thick husks. We're thick-headed. We're stubborn. We're creatures of habit. We trust what we've done before, even if it didn't work. And we'll keep doing it until we realize this is not working and it's never going to work. And then, whether out of desperation or faith or conviction, you open up a new door. You start a new path. I'll finish with this passage that I read during the sutra study this week because I like it a lot. It's where the Buddha is talking about how he sees the world. It's how we see the world when we practice from a place of this mind, this Buddha mind, this Buddha nature, this mind that is free of right and wrong, highs and lows, so that then we can actually live in a world of right and wrong and not be so seduced by the delusion of it. And so the Buddha said, I look upon all things as being universally equal in their very nature. It's not something he's doing. He's not applying a lens of equality. He's seeing things as they are. They're equal in the sense that they are not different. They have the same nature. And in that mind, in that reality, in that world, which is this world, he says, I have no mind to favor this or that, to love one or hate another, to elevate one and denigrate another. I am without greed or attachment, without limitation or hindrance. And at all times, for all things, I teach the Dharma equally, as I would for a single person, the same way I do for numerous people. The rain falls equally. Constantly I expound and teach this Dharma. Never have I done anything else. Coming, going, sitting, standing, never to the end growing weary or disheartened. And that's really the heart of the Bodhisattva. Is caring so much, loving you, people, life, humanity, and the possibility, the potential that we have to actually really be human beings, real human beings. So simple. And so never to the end growing weary or disheartened, I bring fullness and satisfaction to the world like a rain that spreads its moisture everywhere, eminent and lowly, superior and inferior, observers of precepts, violators of precepts, those fully endowed with proper demeanor, those who are not fully endowed, those of correct views, those of erroneous views, of keen capacity, of dull capacity. I cause the Dharma to rain on all equally, never being lax or neglectful. What a wonderful aspiration, a way of being in this world. And of course, that's, as Dogen said, aiming high. And that's why Buddhism is such a profoundly aspirational practice, because our nature is so large, so boundless, so possessing this very mind. And we so limit ourselves that we have to have this vision, this possibility, this nature presented to us. And as the Buddha said, he has no virtues that we don't possess. So we can begin to imagine and act out of that imagining, bring intention and aspiration to practice. And at the beginning, it means just doing what is needed at the beginning, developing a meditation practice, doing study, reflecting on, contemplating this, developing your faith, seeing what is in the way. So if you have a lot of faith, a lot of trust in the Dharma, you have a strong motivation, but not much discipline, it's hard to get to the cushion. Work on that, right? Just observe what's happening. What choices does one make that moves one away from the cushion rather than towards? It's workable. If we have a lot of discipline, it's easy to get the cushion, but we're very dull. We don't have a lot of faith. Just recognize our own particular mind, our own particular acquired, learned, developed habits. There's nothing fixed in there. That's why the Buddha doesn't become disheartened or grow weary, because you're nothing but change. There's nothing fixed in there. And that deeply embedded, fully endowed seed is very affected, influenced by our environment, by our conditions. So when you create conditions within yourself and your life, that rain is falling. You don't see, we don't always see how that sprout is beginning to come forth. Don't sit and watch it. Right? Trust. And you will see signs along the way, but don't worry about that, because that'll just end up getting us all entangled. And it's another success and failure project. And so I encourage, particularly those of you here for the weekend, those who are maybe showing up at the early stages, to recognize that there is a seed. There's a reason why we are here today. And even if it's not entirely clear, that's fine. It rarely is in the beginning. But something's happening. There's movement. Put some rain on that. And then put some more. That will benefit you undecidedly, unequivocally, but it will also benefit us. And we need us in this, and not just this, not just Buddha Dharma. We need people in the world who want to live and want others to live. And there are many. And one more is one more. That's a good thing.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.